Good evening. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Congress violates the human rights of Americans when it voted to end some support of the Saudi war in Yemen.
The senators who voted aye say they want to end the bombing in Yemen and support human rights. But we really need to think about whose human rights.
An attorney who defended John Gotti Sr. says the mob is often misunderstood.
There is a business model for the mafia, and the business model is the ultimate in laissez-faire capitalism. Everything has a price, and the idea is to accumulate as much wealth as possible.
And the indigenous Pemon people of Venezuela get caught in the middle of a brutal fight at the border with Brazil. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, March 15, 2019. First to Linda Perry.
New Zealand police said at least 49 people were killed today at two mosques during Friday prayers in the picturesque South Island city of Christchurch. Another 48 suffered gunshot wounds. Toxic beliefs were behind an unprecedented live-stream massacre streamed on Facebook for 17 minutes using an app designed for extreme sports enthusiasts, with copies shared on social media hours later. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern called the massacre a terrorist attack in one of New Zealand's darkest days. One man was arrested and charged with murder. The self-proclaimed racist used rifles covered in white supremacist graffiti and in the live stream listened to a song glorifying a Bosnian Serb war criminal. The killer posted meme-heavy hate speech prominent in dark corners of the internet. Beneath the online tropes is a man who matter-of-factly wrote that he was preparing to conduct a horrific attack. Police defused explosive devices in a car. Two other people are in custody. World leaders expressed condolences and condemnation Friday following the deadly attacks on these mosques in New Zealand. While Muslim leaders said the mass shooting was evidence of a rising tide of violent Islamophobia, New Zealand has only 1% Muslim population in a country of about 5 million people. Turkish President Erdogan said the Islamophobia that motivated the attacks is rapidly starting to take over Western communities like a cancer. Pakistan's prime minister echoed those sentiments. He tweeted, "I blame these increasing terror attacks on the current Islamophobia post-9/11, where Islam's 1.3 billion Muslims have collectively been blamed for any act of terror by a Muslim." Jordan's King Abdullah II tweeted, "The heinous massacre against Muslims praying in peace in New Zealand is an appalling terrorist crime. It unites us against extremism, hatred, and terrorism, which knows no religion." Jordan's foreign ministry confirmed that one Jordanian was killed and five wounded in the attack. Several of those killed or wounded in the shooting rampage were from the Middle East or South Asia, from Bangladesh, Pakistan, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, and Indonesia. Mayor Bill de Blasio said New York City is providing extra security for Muslim community centers and mosques. He said he wants the city's Muslims to know that New Yorkers truly embrace them and have their backs. Over to you, Paul.
Thanks, Linda. President Donald Trump issued the first veto of his presidency on Friday, overruling Congress to protect his emergency declaration for border wall funding.
Consistent with the law and the legislative process designed by our founders, today I am vetoing this resolution. Congress has the freedom to pass this resolution, and I have the duty to veto it, and I'm very proud to veto it. Since 1976, presidents have declared 59 national emergencies. They often involve protecting foreign citizens in far-off lands, yet Congress has not terminated any of them. Every single one of them is still in existence. And yet we don't worry about our land, we worry about other people's lands. That's why I say America first, if that's okay. America first.
Trump maintained that he is not through fighting for his signature campaign promise, which stands largely unfulfilled 18 months before voters decide whether to grant him another term. A dozen defecting Republicans joined Senate Democrats in approving the joint resolution on Thursday, but it's unlikely Congress will have the two-thirds majority required to override Trump's veto. House Democrats have suggested they would try nonetheless. Trump wants to use the emergency order to divert billions of federal dollars earmarked for defense spending toward the southern border wall. Trump is expected to issue his second veto in the coming weeks over a congressional resolution seeking to end U.S. backing for the Saudi Arabian-led coalition fighting in Yemen. The resolution was approved in the aftermath of the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. On Wednesday, the United States Senate voted 54-46 to withdraw U.S. forces involved in the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen. The resolution was originally passed by the Senate in December, but Speaker Paul Ryan refused to hold a vote while the Republicans held a majority in the House. The resolution now passed by both houses of Congress is the first to use the War Powers Act since its enactment in 1973 and directs the White House to end support of the Saudi military, including aerial targeting assistance, intelligence gathering, and mid-flight aerial refueling, along with providing a diplomatic cover at the United Nations. Secretary of State Pompeo spoke on Friday.
We all want this conflict to end. We all want to improve the dire humanitarian situation. But the Trump administration fundamentally disagrees that curbing our assistance to the Saudi-led coalition is the way to achieve these goals. The senators who voted aye say they want to end the bombing in Yemen and support human rights. But we really need to think about whose human rights. If you truly care about Yemeni lives, you'd support the Saudi-led effort to prevent Yemen from turning into a puppet state of the corrupt, brutish Islamic Republic of Iran. If we truly care about Saudi lives, you'd want to stop Iran-backed Houthis from launching missiles into Riyadh. If you truly care about Arab lives in the region, you'd support allied efforts to prevent Iran from extending its authoritarian rule from Tehran to the Mediterranean Sea and on down to Yemen. And if we truly care about American lives and livelihoods and the lives and livelihoods of people all around the world, you'd understand that Iran and its proxies cannot be allowed to control the shipping lanes that abut Yemen. We're deeply aware of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, and we deplore it. The United States has given more than $2 billion to help the Yemeni people since the start of the conflict. And Saudi Arabia has given over $500 million in 2018 alone and has pledged an additional $500 million this year. The Islamic Republic of Iran has provided $0 for humanitarian assistance. The way to alleviate the Yemeni people's suffering isn't to prolong the conflict by handicapping our partners in the fight, but by giving the Saudi-led coalition the support needed to defeat Iranian-backed rebels and ensure a just peace. We hope, I met with Martin Griffiths yesterday, we hope that agreements can be implemented to de-escalate, but we must make sure that this crisis comes to an end.
The action by the Senate was sponsored by Democrat Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Republican Mike Lee of Utah. After some maneuvering by opponents discussed on Thursday's edition of the WBAI News, the bill was finally passed and expected to go to Trump's desk, where he's expected to veto the law. Peace activist and co-director of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, Kathy Kelly, says the White House is scheming to continue its support of Saudi Arabia in the face of growing opposition at home.
It's likely that Secretary of State Pompeo wants to divert attention away from the years of United States cruelty toward people in Yemen. I'm thinking particularly of children. 87,500 children have already died of disease and starvation caused by a war that the United States is completely complicit in waging. I think that, the Saudis right now are accused by the New York Times in December of 2018 of using children from Darfur, to fight on the ground in Yemen, while they use remote piloting and drone surveillance to wage their war. Well, the United States has certainly been a companion to the United States in waging remote-controlled warfare. And these are terrible human rights abuses, and there's such desperation in, for instance, Darfur and the Horn of Africa. So Secretary of State Pompeo should be educating the U.S. public about these realities, helping us better understand why there is so much suffering and desperation in Yemen, and not trying to pass it off as something that really should be blamed on Iran.
Do you hold out hope for the legislation that's been passed as a positive position that might actually help?
Well, I think there is a good combination of people in grassroots fashion all across the United States saying, we care. We care about this issue. And I think that grassroots activism combined with a willingness on the part of some legislators to say we're not going to be dominated by the military weapon-making companies and by the designs of people who'd like to bludgeon Yemen into submission, submitting to the Saudis. So that's good. But we should also be realistic and recognize that even if the War Powers Act is invoked as something that Congress should decide upon, still the United States itself is using airstrikes to hit people in Yemen that they suspect being part of Al-Qaeda. And Saudi Arabia is just one of a 10-country coalition, and the United States could still be arming the Emiratis and cooperating with the Emirati prison network in Yemen. So there's a lot more to do as well.
Anything you'd like to add?
This is a very, very crucial time. The starvation and desperation in Yemen is continually worsening by the day. So it's a crucial time to continue saying to elected leadership in the United States and all throughout the world and in the humanitarian groups that are present in Yemen, we're not going to walk away from these issues.
Kathy Kelly is a peace activist and co-director of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Secretary Pompeo also announced Friday that the United States will revoke or deny visas to international criminal court personnel seeking to investigate alleged war crimes and other abuses committed by U.S. forces in Afghanistan or elsewhere. He added the U.S. may do the same with those who seek action against Israel.
We are determined to protect the American and allied military and civilian personnel from living in fear of unjust prosecution for actions taken to defend our great nation. We feared that the court could eventually pursue politically motivated prosecutions of Americans, and our fears were warranted. In November of 2017, the ICC prosecutor requested approval to initiate an investigation into, quote, the situation in Afghanistan, end of quote, that could illegitimately target American personnel for prosecutions and sentencing. In September of 2018, the Trump administration warned the ICC that if it tried to pursue an investigation of Americans, there would be consequences. I understand that the prosecutor's request for an investigation remains pending. Thus, today, persistent to existing legal authority to impose visa restrictions on any alien, quote, whose entry or proposed activities in the United States would have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences, end of quote, I'm announcing a policy of U.S. visa restrictions on those individuals directly responsible for any ICC investigation of U.S. personnel.
The International Criminal Court was set up in 1998 under a treaty signed in Rome. As of March 2019, there are 124 nations that are party to the treaty. There are four core international crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and crimes of aggression. The ICC can only investigate and prosecute international crimes in situations where states are unable or unwilling to do so themselves. Journalist Ian Williams is author of Untold, The Real Story of the UN. He says Pompeo's statement is in violation of numerous agreements signed by the United States and ratified by the United States Senate.
It is basically the U.S.'s resignation from international society. It breaks so many international treaties signed and ratified by the Senate, I might add, that it's almost impossible to count. You know, first of all, these people are officials of the United Nations. And there's a convention that the U.S. has signed that they will not stop people coming here in execution of U.N. business. Secondly, the U.S. did sign, everyone's forgotten this, the U.S. did sign the Rome Convention on the International Criminal Court. So it's still sort of bound not to hinder it. And it just counts in so many different ways. Against the United States, which already has a tattered reputation internationally. But every time the U.S. or Pompeo, for example, gets up and says this and that country is breaking international law and there should be sanctions against them, he's just made a big knife for his own back. You can't turn around to Nicaragua or Iran or someone else and say you're breaking international law. Oh, and by the way, we're going to carry on breaking international law.
What does America first mean in the world today?
It means America first and last. But increasingly, I mean, 20 or 30 years ago, America could afford to be first. Immediately after the downfall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. could take a stance like this. But increasingly, as events have shown, it depends on other people. It needs help to fulfill its ambitions. It needs to win over NATO. It needs to persuade people across the world to cooperate with it. And increasingly, Donald Trump is giving the finger. So it's one thing. At one point in the 30s, the U.S. could afford to be isolationist almost. It was economically self-contained. Now it's integrated so thoroughly into the world economy and world politics that every move like this diminishes America's prestige and leverages with the rest of the world. It means even America's best friends, you know, God help us, the British are rolling their eyes at stuff like this because the British have signed on for the International Criminal Court. Even the French eventually signed on for the International Criminal Court. It's a few rogue regimes, and the U.S. are the only ones that have stepped away from it. No, because basically we're saying that war criminals can go around with impunity. That's what they're announcing to the world.
What could come of this? What could be the final result of this?
It's difficult to tell. There are various responses. It's just occurred to me when the U.S. refused to allow Yasser Arafat to get a visa to come into the United Nations, the United Nations voted to go to Geneva to listen to him, which was, you know, a fairly spectacular gesture of contempt for the U.S. And I think we're going to see more and more of that.
Journalist Ian Williams is author of Untold, The Real Story of the UN. Meanwhile, several people were killed in demonstrations along the Venezuelan border with Brazil in early March. Among those killed were members of the Pemán Indians who attempted to block Venezuelan troops from entering their lands. The Pemán live in a wild and remote area near what may have been the site of the fictional story The Lost World by Arthur Conan Doyle. The advocacy director for the tribal rights organization Survival International is Fiona Watson. She says the deaths of the lightly armed indigenous people have received almost no coverage in the world's media.
This incident we're talking about involves a tribe called the Pemón. There are about 30,000 of them. Most of them live in the southern part of Venezuela and a few in Guyana and neighboring Brazil. And in Venezuela, their land is in the most extraordinary area. It's incredible. It's full of savannas, forest, and these amazing flat-top, like table mountains, which they call tepuis.
What happened?
As far as we know, on the 22nd of February, there was a horrible shootout on the road that passes through Pemón land from the sort of center of Venezuela. It goes right down to the Brazil border. And there's a community there called Cumaracapai, and they were blockading the road. And that was to stop the army from reaching the frontier with Brazil, because they had been ordered to close the border to prevent humanitarian aid coming in from Brazil. And due to the crisis and chaos in Venezuela, there are great shortages of things like, you know, basic medicines, food, that sort of thing. And the Pemón wanted medicines to come in. And so they were angry that the convoy was going to be stopped. So they blockaded the road and the army fired on them. And one Pemón woman died almost straight away. And then as far as we know, six other people have died, most of whom are Pemón Indians who subsequently died of their injuries. So it was a very brutal attack because the army were clearly armed with guns and the Pemón, from what I can see in the videos, were not armed at all. Or if they did have arms, they were bows and arrows, which are no match at all for firepower. And then after that, the whole area went down into lockdown. Troops were sent to the border town called Santa Elena. And I've seen video there of shooting, tanks on the street, lots of shooting, people fleeing. And Pemón that I have spoken to, in fact, one of my good Pemón friends says that his in-laws have fled the area. So there's a lot of tension, a lot of violence, many Pemón in hiding. Many were arrested. Subsequently, some of them have been released. So it's a pretty chaotic situation, actually.
How does this fit into the politics of the region?
The politics are undoubtedly complicated. I think what's been going on in this particular area where the Pemong live is that, and in fact it's the same in other parts of Venezuela that I know of, is the breakdown of law and order. And Venezuela, parts of Venezuela, including the Pemong territory, have been overrun by what they call sindicatos, which are these kind of armed gangs or militias, drug traffickers, people who are taking advantage of the general chaos as Venezuela slides and, you know, is in crisis. There's also a big problem, and has been for a while, on Pemong land, which has to do with gold mining. There are gold mining companies, and in fact, President Maduro several years ago announced a massive corporate scheme whereby that's called the mining arch of the Orinoco. The Orinoco is the main river in this region. And it's a huge scheme whereby a lot of indigenous territories and protected areas would be opened up to large-scale mining. So many indigenous peoples, including the Pemong, are very worried about this. So if you put all these factors together, like the looming threat of large-scale gold mining, the breakdown of law and order, these sindicato groups acting like militias, doing what they like, it's a very toxic and volatile situation. And in fact, in December, one Pemong was killed by the intelligence services of Venezuela, who were going into an area with a view to getting out small-scale gold miners to pave the way for large-scale gold mining. So there was a conflict over that. The recent killing of Pemong last month has to be really looked at in that context.
And that's Fiona Watson, an advocacy director for the tribal rights organization Survival International. And in New York, the assassination of Frankie Boy Colley, an alleged Gambino boss, is under investigation. Colley, 53, died in a hail of gunfire outside his Staten Island home late Wednesday. Attorney Ron Kuby and his former law partner, famed civil rights attorney Bill Kunstler, once represented the late John Gotti, who has been named as a member of the so-called Gambino crime family. But Kuby says he never heard any reference to namesake Carlo Gambino, who died peacefully in his Long Island home in 1976.
Nobody representing themselves as the Gambino crime family ever invited me to a meeting or a sit-down or a membership committee or a character and fitness committee. Mr. Kunstler and I did represent John Gotti Sr. In some proceedings many, many, many years ago that largely involved the government depriving him of his attorney of choice. And, you know, we were very proud to take a role in those proceedings. Those involved issues of fundamental constitutional importance. Subsequently, after Bill Kunstler died, I played a small role in trying to negotiate a guilty plea for John Gotti the Younger and a number of his associates. But Gambino crime family, Paul, I don't know anything about a Gambino crime family.
What was John Gotti like working with him? Did you get to have dinner with him or a drink with him or just meet with him in an office and talk to him, find out what kind of guy he was?
John Gotti the Elder and I mean, we didn't hang out, but I did get to know him through the course of representation. He was extraordinarily smart, extraordinarily charismatic, and he had a very nice touch for regular people. I mean, I think in a different life, he would have been the CEO of a giant multinational corporation and probably would have gotten away with killing people by the tens of thousands, like Union Carbide or the Koch brothers. Instead, he ended up going a different route. I found him always to be unfailingly pleasant. And he used to call me Ronnie. And there were only two people in the world who called me Ronnie. One was my grandmother, and the other was John Gotti. And I never corrected either of them for pretty much the same reason.
And that's Ron Kuby. Ron Kuby and Bill Kunstler, his former partner, were removed from the Gotti case for their success, along with attorney Bruce Cutler, in winning acquittals for the Teflon Don, who was eventually convicted and died in prison in 2002. And in more local news, five teenage robot makers from Brooklyn are getting ready to compete in a citywide competition this weekend at City College. They call themselves the Sunset Park Astros, and over the past few months, they've been building and programming robots using a Lego set called Mindstorm EV3. Reva Goldberg went to a recent Astros practice at the Sunset Park Library to see how the team is feeling about the upcoming competition.
The Astros have been working on their robots at the Sunset Park Library in Brooklyn for the past few months. There are three girls and two boys on the team. In February, the Astros played in a tournament against 11 other Brooklyn teams and won first place. There are more than 60 teams going to the citywide championship in Manhattan this weekend.
Okay, so can y'all tell me what y'all got so far right now?
Keenan Jones is the technology resource specialist at the Sunset Park Library, and he's the coach of the Astros.
Me being a coach, I see they're very strong at working together. I love it because, like, they share ideas and, you know, the way they think about things is so good.
The theme for this year is Into Orbit, so the playing field is a colorful mat that looks like space spread out on a long table. There are Lego missions set up on Earth, Mars, a space station, and other spots. The Astros are coding their robot to move across the mat and do the missions as efficiently as possible using arms and attachments they designed.
How many points is it, like?
18 in total, if you move all four.
Arnold, who's 15, is about to test a mission. The robot has to go to Earth and hit what looks like a little rocket launcher with enough force to send the rocket up.
Yeah, see, I didn't finish programming it. If I were to place it correctly, it would have enough power to send it up. But I just need more weight.
The missions are a big part of the competition, but the Astros also have to make a presentation about a real-life space problem and give ideas for how to solve it. Michelle, who's 15, wants to focus on sleep deprivation in space, but Arnold would rather focus on the dangers of space debris.
Like, the space that you're sleeping in is, like, pretty cramped. So, like, we want to kind of, like, improve the quality of their sleep. And also, they might experience problems such as, like, motion sickness and nightmares and dreams.
If space debris is left alone, it could travel up to 17,500 miles per hour, which is fast enough for a particle that's as small as dust to completely obliterate a spacecraft. So I think we could use space debris, and I think it is a better choice.
How are you going to solve space debris? You need a lot of materials. You also need, like, a lot of money.
You keep working on space debris. Yeah, I work on sleeping in space. I'll read it over, and tomorrow morning I'll give y'all a decision.
The top two teams from this weekend will compete in Detroit in April with teams from all over the world. Right now, though, the Astros are focused on the big weekend in front of them.
It's, like, always intense. Like, any time is always intense, especially when the clock ticks down to 30 seconds and we have a lot of mission to do.
It's just, like, excitement and nervousness all in one. I just don't know what happened.
All right, guys, it's time to wrap up. We're going to continue this tomorrow.
This is Reva Goldberg for WBAI News in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. Margaret Schaefer contributed to this story.
You won't stop until you get there.
And that's some of the news for Friday, March 15th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry, Jennifer Hoge, and Reva Goldberg. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. Thanks for joining us for the WBAI News. I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.